This information is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information with regard to the subject matter covered. It is offered with the understanding that the presenters are not engaged in rendering legal, accounting, or other professional services. If legal advice or other expert advice is required, the services of a competent professional should be sought.
Welcome to the Knoxville Real Estate Investing and Real Estate Financial Planning Podcast. Learn all about investing in real estate in Knoxville, Tennessee, with a combination of real estate financial planning and modeling with numbers specific to Knoxville, plus syndicated, more generalized recordings of live and pre-recorded real estate investing classes, not all of them specific to Knoxville. Be sure to stay tuned after the podcast for a message from our sponsors.
Well, good morning and welcome, everyone. I am your host, James Orr, and this is another episode of the Danger, Warning, the Risks of Investing in Real Estate. And today we're going to cover probably one of the more common fears I hear from potential landlords, new real estate investors. I think this is a fear that comes up for a lot of folks. I would say from folks that don't have the experience of being a landlord, haven't seen this firsthand, and or people that are investing in a particularly challenging part of the real estate market. I think that what you'll find out today when we cover this particular thing is you'll find out that certain people have this fear because they chose to invest in a part of the real estate market where this is a much more likely, much more frequent occurrence. So what am I talking about? The risks of tenants trashing properties when investing in real estate. This is like the common fear, right? This is the one where, you know, people are really scared that they're going to buy a property, they're going to lease it out to a tenant, and that the tenants are going to trash the place, and they're going to get it back, and they're going to have, you know, $50,000 worth of repairs they need to make on the particular property. Well, maybe that happens. I mean, I don't think it's unheard of, but as far as like frequency goes and the amount of damage goes, you're much more likely to see a small amount of damage and for it to be very infrequent, especially if you make some good choices and you do things properly. You kind of follow some best practices. So let's jump right into it. So as part of the series, this is the entire series we're doing is all about overcoming fears. Like this is the, you know, I've got these fears. This is why I'm not investing in real estate. So I have this great quote from George S. Patton, the general, and he says, "The time to take counsel of your fears is before you make an important battle decision. That's the time to listen to every fear you can imagine, like tenants perhaps doing damage to your properties and having a plan in place for that." Continuing with the quote, "When you have collected all the facts and fears and made your decision, turn off all your fears and go ahead." So once you decide, hey, look, you know, I've looked at all of the other options I have. I've considered all the other things that I can invest in. And based on my goals, my criteria, my risk tolerance levels, and what I'm willing to deal with, and how likely these risks are to happen to me, and how I could deal with them if they do happen to me, I still think that real estate investing is the right vehicle, the right kind of investment strategy that I plan on using. And so at that point, you've made your decision, then turn off all your fears and move ahead and then address things as they come up. So this is part of that series to help you understand what the risks are, what we can do about them. Some of them we can completely eliminate. Some of them we can mitigate the effect of. Some of them we can just understand a little bit more about how likely they are and how big they're going to be. And we can kind of move ahead with that knowledge, being more knowledgeable. So what are we talking about? We're talking about trash properties. And this could be a range of things from, you know, tenants just not caring for the property like you would, as an example, or a tenant's, and this is usually a much more unusual and much more extreme example, but tenants sometimes deliberately causing damage, often as some type of retaliation against being treated poorly or what they perceive as unfairly by you or your representatives, you know, a property manager, for example, doing that, or a contractor treating them badly. You know, if they don't feel respected, a certain percentage, a very small percentage, in my opinion, of tenants may decide to take that out on you and your property. And they may choose to just not take care of things and just kind of let things go and to kind of just throw it on you and be like, oh, that's for you to deal with, not for me. And so I think there's a very small percentage of tenants that feel that way. The overwhelming majority of tenants are going to take care of your property. Maybe not quite as nice, as much, as well as you would take care of your property. Although I've seen some landlords where the tenants take care of their property better than the landlord would take care of their property. But I think that is also the exception. I think that the number of people that don't take care of things is relatively small. And so there's some things we could do about that, which we'll talk about here in a little bit. So trash properties, that's primarily what we're talking about here. And I think part of that can be mitigated and part of it can be reduced if you change your mindset, if you make this little tiny tweak in how you think about renting a property. You know, sometimes we think about renting a property as, oh, I'm just going to lease this property to them and I'm going to collect whatever it is, $800 a month, $1,500 a month, $2,700 a month, you know, $3,500 a month, whatever the rent is on your property there. And you don't actually think about what is really happening. What is really happening is you're loaning somebody a multi-$100,000 asset. You know, if your buddy came over to you and they're like, hey, can I borrow your shovel? Or can I borrow your wheelbarrow? Can I borrow your lawnmower? Or can I borrow your laptop? And you're like, no, I don't trust that you're going to take care of my, you know, $2,500 laptop. I'm not loaning you that. Yet we will go lease a $300,000 property to a tenant and not do the due diligence and not think about this as if they are borrowing a multi-$100,000 asset from us. And so I think if we have that mindset going in, it really changes how we structure our written tenant approval criteria, the kind of written tenant selection stuff that you know you should have in order to comply with fair housing. You know, you should have some type of written criteria that you follow for every single applicant that comes in and you approve them based on this very well-documented written criteria. So when we think about loaning someone a, you know, $200,000 house or $300,000 house or $500,000 house or $1 million house, we think about it as we are loaning them $300,000. And we want to make sure that they are qualified to take care of it for us. So now we need to have the written criteria reflect what type of person we would loan a $300,000 asset to. And then that follows through to using your written tenant approval criteria in your actual tenant screening and tenant approval process. Okay. So, you know, even if you kind of like, if you're not willing to go to the extreme of, hey, I'm loaning them a $300,000 house, a $300,000 asset, maybe you think of it more in terms of, in the amount of damage a tenant could do and say, look, you know, I want to avoid a $50,000 repair bill on a particular rental property. What can I do to screen a tenant to make that less likely to happen and to make it less likely that even if it does happen, that I can have some recourse on a particular tenant for doing that? And so when you start thinking about that way, it changes how you think about your written tenant approval criteria, your written tenant selection criteria, and also your tenant screening process. So what I would encourage you to do is I would encourage proper tenant screening to reduce your risk. And, you know, that there's a wide range that I'm not covering tenant screening in detail today. However, there's a couple things I want to point out that if you never go listen to my tenant screening class or you never attend that class and you learn about that from me, here's a couple things that are particularly germane to this particular point. And so one of them is ideally inspect the tenant's current property, where they currently live. And if you're unable to do that, at least inspect their car, how they arrived at the property in order to go look at it and see, because how their current property looks, and to a slightly lesser degree, how their car looks, is how your property is likely to look if they lease it from you. If you go to their current property and it's a mess and their dog's taking a dump all over the floor and, you know, they've got, you know, like not just dirty dishes, but like rotting food on the counter, and you know the fridge has got rotting food in it, and you know the bathrooms haven't been cleaned in the 11 months that they were in the property currently, and it looks like it, and it smells like it, and you know this like grease and grime all over the light switches and stuff like that. If that's the way their current property looks, guess how your property is very likely to look. Yep, just like that. And to a lesser degree, if you go look at their car and it's got, you know, 13 previously had fast food bags with garbage and things are thrown on the floor and the car is not clean and it's dirty and it's got broken windows and it's got like, you know, a garbage bag covering the one back window that they're, you know, unwilling to replace or repair. And they're driving that car around and it's got like, you know, a donut on as one of the tires. If that's what you see, that's their level of expectation for how they're willing to live. And that's very likely how your property will be treated. So that's an understanding that is a really critical point for should you loan this property to them and what you're likely to discover, what you're likely to see in terms of how the property is maintained and the damage you're left with when they move out of the property based on their current residence and their current car to a slightly lesser degree, I would say. I would also insist on positive landlord references and be careful of the current landlord giving them a positive reference just to get them out. You want to go back and do at least the previous landlord and get a true reference from them as to how things are. And if you can't get a reference, that's a big red flag for me. And so maybe your criteria is if you can't get a reference, it's a no. And you're just willing to deal with the consequences of that. Because I would rather have a little bit more vacancy than a $50,000 repair bill. And that's what it could be, right? I mean, I don't think it's like a high probability, but the more things you do that are risky, like let tenants in without any type of references from previous landlords or background checks, that they don't have any evictions and damages and collections for repairs on stuff that they didn't do in the previous property, or their current property is a total wreck. Like if you don't do that, you are voluntarily taking on that additional risk. So think about it that way. And if you're not willing to do this, if you're not willing to put in a very good written tenant approval process, selection criteria for approving your tenants, and like following the letter of your own rules for screening tenants and approving tenants using that particular set of criteria, if you're not willing to hold yourself to that and you've got like a big heart and any person who comes to you with a story about how, they're just down on their luck and they really need someone to just give them a chance, realize that you can be charitable in any way you want. That's your choice, right? But what I would encourage you to do is be charitable deliberately, not by them moving into your property and then you having to put $50,000 in repairs because you gave them a chance. I would rather you help somebody out by paying some money to, give somebody a opportunity to lease a property somewhere else if they're going to damage the property, rather than you voluntarily being, well, not voluntarily, but you choosing to be forced to pay $50,000 in repairs when really you wanted to be generous by helping someone, get back on their feet. Help them get back on their feet by giving them money and letting them do somewhere else, but follow your own rules about tenant selection. This is a business. You should treat it like a business and then be charitable somewhere else. Be charitable deliberately in your own way and don't like let the two mix unless this is your charity, right? There's some investors that they are deciding to invest in real estate so that they can give these opportunities to people, and that is their charity. Well, that's your choice. If you want to do it that way, that's totally up to you. And then have that in your written tenant selection criteria, that is the way that you are going to choose which tenant go in there, okay? But if you're not willing to do that job, if you're not willing to be firm, to be diligent, to kind of be disciplined in how you apply these tenant screening processes and your property management in general, then hire a professional who will. Don't just allow the damage to happen because you were unwilling to be firm and fair in your policies and how you applied those policies fairly to people across the board. Hire a professional who is willing to do that for you if you're not willing to do it yourself. Okay, pet damage. So some of the times when your tenant causes damage to the property, it's not them directly. It's just that they have a pet. And, And I'm sure there are kind of like people that train pets for a living who are going to say, James, you're full of crap, right? Every pet can be trained. But I think that there are some pets that they are just super mellow and they don't do damage and there's no training that's required. It's just that they happen to be lucky and that their pet doesn't do damage. And then there's probably some that with some training, they could probably reduce the amount of damage that their pet would do. But I think that there's a certain percentage of the population where their pet's probably going to do damage and they don't train their pet and they don't enforce their pet to behave. And so you are likely to see sometimes that a pet will do damage to your property. So some pets are well-behaved and will result in minimal or normal wear and tear in a property. And I think that's what ideally you'd like to see. But I think some pets are going to do minor damage and their pet fees will usually cover some, maybe even all of that damage. And then there's another group where there will be times when a pet will do a lot of damage to your property and it will exceed whatever pet fees, especially if you're doing additional fees for pets, that you'll see on a property and that you'll have to deal with those damages caused by that particular pet, which as you will find out here next, you have some choice over a little bit of this. And let me explain what I mean by this. So as a real estate investor, as someone running your business, you get to choose a little bit of what is going on in your real estate investment business. For example, you get to choose what part of the real estate market you invest in. For example, I have a picture here on the screen of a relatively rough, neighborhood. If you choose to invest in properties like this, what incentive does a tenant have to maintain a property at a really high level when every other property on the street is run down, boarded up, and looks really, really, really rough? Very little. And so you get to choose if you want to invest in properties in areas like this, where you are the nicest property on the street and everyone else around you is really rough. Your tenants probably are not incentivized to take care of a property. Now, if they live in a nice neighborhood and all of the houses are like extremely well manicured, there's an incentive for them to keep up appearances with the neighbors and maintain the property. Now, does that mean that they always will? No. But does it mean that there's a little bit of peer pressure from the neighbors for maintaining the property? I think a little bit. And so you get to decide to a certain degree, and this is not like a magic bullet that solves all your problems, right? But this is sort of like stacking the odds in your favor. Now, which part of the real estate market you invest in is a choice that you can make. And if you decide to invest in, you know, slightly nicer properties, you are likely to do that. And part of this is price range. If you're investing at the very, very low end of the market, number one is the property quality tends to be a little bit lower, the lower end of the properties, the lower price point you're at. And also, the people that tend to rent those properties may or may not have resources. So I was hinting at this before, but if you go and you have a rent a property to somebody and, you know, they are at the very low end of rent, you know, bottom 5% of rental properties in your particular marketplace, they may or may not, but I think that the odds are that they are less likely to have additional resources where if they do damage to the property, you could go back on them and get them to pay for the damages that they cause in excess of their security deposit. Whereas as the price increases, I think that it's not universal, but I think that there is a slightly increased probability that they will have at least some resources to be able to handle some of the excess damage that they could possibly do to a property that they could then go and pay. And you could go after them and, you know, get a judgment against them in order to have them pay the amount of money. Or when they go to finally try to buy a house, they may have a lien on it and may have to deal with that in order to get addressed. So I think that there's a probability. And it's not like this is a, you know, a super perfect solution in every single case, but I think that the odds are the higher the income, the more likely someone is to be able to handle additional overages if they have damage to the property. Whereas if you're on the very, very low price of the marketplace, it is harder to do that. Okay. So you get to choose which part of the real estate market you invest in and the price range of the properties that you decide to buy. And to a certain degree, the types of tenants you want. Now, I'm not talking about violating fair housing. I want you to completely comply with fair housing, but I'll give you an example of what I mean by this. Student rentals. You're not going to say only students can rent here or students can't rent here. I'm not talking about doing that specifically, but if you're buying a property that is in a student rental part of a particular town and it's right by the university and you're renting it out by rooms, as an example, then you are much more likely to attract students to your rentals. So you get to choose that as a real estate investor. You get to decide, do you want to deal with 19, 20, 21-year-old students whose brains may not be completely formed, who may not be making the most bestest decisions. I mean, I was like 18, 19, 21 at one point. I've had, you know, two sons go through that age. I understand that there is some, it's not perfect rational thinking at that age. You know, they're not fully formed brains and don't always make the right choices with stuff. And I think we all go through that. So do you want to take on that additional risk? Do you want to take on that liability? And sure, you can go get a, you know, parent to co-sign and the parents can make sure that the parents have resources that you can go after them if there's damage. I get all that, right? But you're choosing to a certain degree the types of tenants that you choose to take on by deciding on your business model and how you go after that. And I want to make sure I completely tell you, always follow fair housing laws. I'm not telling you to violate fair housing, not telling you to discriminate in any way. I'm just saying, to a certain degree, you can choose a little bit of the business model you pursue and doing that. This reminds me of an amazing chart in the Gary Keller book, The Millionaire Real Estate Investor. And this is what the chart looks like. It's like one of my favorite charts from that. But that book's really, really good, by the way. You should go read it. I've read that book several times. It's an amazing book for real estate investors. However, this is one of my favorite charts in there. And what it shows is they're basically suggesting what price point of the market they recommend you should be in. And so over here is low-end properties. Over here are high-end properties, expensive properties. And here are the average price properties. And then they're showing whether this is a low, medium, or high. And they rank it based on four different criteria. How good the cash flow is, how much of a hassle factor it is to run a rental property business at that price point, what the likely appreciation rates are going to be in that price point, and then how liquid it is, how easy it is to buy and sell properties in that marketplace. And so, for example, for liquidity, on the low-end properties, they tend to be low liquidity. So it's harder to get in and out of those deals. There's a smaller market for it. And so it tends to be harder to get in and out of those particular properties. On the average price properties, it's really easy to get in and out of those properties. And on the high end, it's low as well. So liquidity is low on the high end properties, and on the low end, it's the highest at the average price properties. Now, as far as appreciation goes, appreciation is sort of like low to medium on the low end properties. It's the highest on the average price properties and a little bit lower on the high end properties as far as historical appreciation rates go. And then as far as hassle factor goes, the hassle factor is highest at this low-end properties, it's lowest at the average properties, and it's also very high on the high-end properties. So this sort of like this dip where the hassle factor is lowest on these average-type properties. And then in terms of cash flow, the cash flow tends to be the best on these low-end properties. It tends to be in the middle on these average properties and a little bit below that medium to low on the high-end properties. So when you look at all of these four factors combined, the cash flow kind of factors, the hassle factors, the appreciation factors, and the liquidity factors, what they suggest is the good deals are sort of in the average sort of price properties, right? The average is where it is. And so what I think of that as is, you know, look at the median price property in your marketplace, and like right around there are sort of like the good deals. Then a little bit below that, but not the cheapest stuff, a little bit below that is where the great deals are, according to Gary Keller in The Millionaire Real Estate Investor. The great deals are sort of in that, what I would call the second quartile, the kind of like, not the lowest price properties, but like, and not the like lowest 25% of properties on the marketplace, but sort of in that 25% to the 50%, like that range of price of properties is the sort of sweet spot that goes from like good deals to great deals. That's sort of where you want to be, in my opinion. Now, there's lots of variations. Some people have to decide, hey, I'm going for a high-end real estate investing strategy and I want to be on the high end. And there's definitely folks that are going the very, very low end. They're like, I only got, you know, $14,000 for a down payment. So I got to keep my property price below, you know, $65,000 because that's the price I'm going for. And that's what I have to invest. That's my down payment amount. So you can look at these things as that. But I would suggest if you're thinking about this is in terms of mitigating risk, mitigating, like maximizing cash flow, minimizing hassle, maximizing appreciation, and keeping a good fair amount of liquidity in your marketplace, in your kind of like investment, this sort of like second quartile 25% pricing to about the 50th percentile pricing, like below the median, but not the very, very low end of the market is another way of describing that, is kind of where you want to be. And they recommend being in that middle of the marketplace. Okay. So I just want to give you some clarity as to, you know, what are some examples of tenant damage? You know, there's everything from holes in the wall, broken windows, you know, damaged flooring, including like wearing out the carpet and kind of like holes in the vinyl. And, you know, like if you have a luxury vinyl plank or something like that, occasionally there's a plank that comes up where they spill water on your kind of wood floors and damages that, like damaged flooring, broken appliances, you know, refrigerators going out, stoves going out, stove top things going off and like getting all nasty where they have to be replaced, you know, stains on the carpet and upholstery, clogged toilets and drains, graffiti on walls, pet damage, water damage, fire damage, mold and mildew, broken locks, missing or damaged fixtures like light fixtures, ceiling fans, things of that nature, broken doors and door frames, damage to the landscaping, damage to the exterior surface like the siding or the roof or whatever it is, pest infestations like, what do they call them, bed bugs or Fleas. I've had a house I had to mitigate for fleas before. Odors from smoking, pets and other sources, unapproved alterations to the property, stolen or damaged property owned by the landlords or the other tenants. So those are some just examples of tenant damage. But what I want to point out to you, if you remember, I taught this class back in May. It's like August, end of August of 2023, when I'm teaching this live class. But back in May, I introduced you to this idea of the risk matrix. And the risk matrix is a way for us to measure which risks we really should fear. And we can look at the likelihood or the frequency that a risk is likely to happen. So these are the least likely things to happen. And then these are the most likely or most frequent things that are going to happen. And then there's a severity thing. You know, the fact that, you know, as an example, that a light switch gets, you know, broken, you know, that's not a major repair. And it's probably not super frequent, but even if it was frequent, the fact that you have to do that type of repair on a property is relatively small. It's a small dollar amount. And even if it's frequent, it's not going to kill you. What you really have to be worried about is these severity things as the severity increases from low severity to really high severity and where the likelihood is highest. This is the risky area. So these are kind of like low risk. Either they're not very likely to happen or they're low cost when they do happen. And then as the cost goes up, and as the frequency goes up, it becomes more risky. So what are like, when you think about damage to a property, is it likely you'll have things like you're going to have to replace the carpet on a property? Yeah, normal wear and tear, you're going to need to replace carpet on a property. You know, other flooring, you're probably going to need to replace that. You know, eventually countertops to a lesser degree, you know, refrigerators and washers and dryers, if you're providing those, and, you know, dishwashers and things like that, they wear out over time. And so you're likely to have those. Now, how frequently do they happen? Well, it depends on the appliance. It depends on how, you know, hard they're living on them and how hard they're doing stuff. But you kind of like think about these things. And most of the time, most of the risks for these tenant damages are going to be relatively low frequency and they're going to be relatively low dollar amount. That's why when you think about the investing world, we're okay for the most part with dealing with a normal security deposit, whatever that is in your marketplace, you know, half month's rent, full month's rent, 2 months rent. Like there's a range of what is normal and what's expected in different marketplaces. And you want to find out what is normal in yours. But I think that's in a reasonable range to handle the overwhelming majority of the cases. Now, are you going to have some cases where a tenant does more damage than their security deposit? Absolutely. But it's not frequent. And sometimes you'll be able to go and collect that from them even after the fact. You tell them, look, you know, you had a $1,500 security deposit. The damages were $1,900. You owe us $400 more. And there's a percentage of tenants that will just write you the check for $400 and they will move on with their lives. There are some tenants that they don't have the $400. And part of that's your choice. You're kind of like living on that very, very low end of the marketplace. That I think there's an increased probability, not universally, but an increased probability that they may not have that extra $400. So just realize that you're choosing some of this. You have a certain say in which risk you're taking on and what's happening here. But I think overall, these are relatively low. Now, are there occasionally times when you just get a bad tenant? You know, you find a tenant and maybe they have something bad happen to them where, you know, they get a divorce and they decide to start using drugs and you're like, hey, listen, you got to maintain the property. And they're like, listen, I'm out of a job. You know, I just lost my wife. And, you know, I started using heroin again and, you know, I'm really just struggling. Maybe they don't tell you that, but you can sense like some of these things, right? So you see that there's challenges going on. And then you start sort of like saying, well, you know, I got to put an eviction notice on your door. And they're like, screw you. I'm now going to take this out on you. Can something like that happen? Yes. I think it's low probability though. And then you have like these, you know, much higher damages on that if something like that happens. I think of an example for me, probably one of the worst houses I had was, we had a really sweet woman and, you know, one of their children living in a property. And like 9 months into the lease, their son, who was in prison, actually was released from prison and decided to move in with them. And they were not approved on a lease. They didn't do that. And the son who was in prison totally destroyed the house. I mean, like was shooting off paintball guns inside the house and they let their dog just go to the bathroom, didn't clean any of it up, just left it there. It was really, really rough. I don't remember exactly what the damages was, but I bet you it was pushing over $25,000 just in damages on the property. But really extreme, unusual case. Like that's like the one horror story I have in this particular situation. I know exactly what caused it. And so you can try to eliminate some of those risks, which we'll talk about here in a second. But I think that's a relatively low probability. and also a low frequency, low probability sort of thing. And the damage wasn't like life ending. I mean, not fun spending that much money on repairs, but it's also like not life ending if you're having those situations. Okay, so that is the risk matrix. I just want you to understand that usually we're dealing with these relatively low likelihood and relatively low severity type events. Sometimes you'll have a little bit more frequently, something will come up, and sometimes you'll have a little bit more expensive, but less frequently things come up. But we're not usually in this kind of like nine area with really high severity and really high likelihood things in terms of tenants and doing damage to properties. Okay, I want to comment. Most of the damage your tenants are going to do will be cosmetic in nature. You know, little things to fix that is that you can easily do on a property and it's not a big deal. Sometimes a tenant will structurally damage the property. It's really uncommon in my opinion. But you know, sometimes a tenant will accidentally drive into the side of the garage, or they will do something to the deck and cause some structural damage to it. Or probably the most common one that I have seen is tenants will not, and sometimes this is like, it's completely unintentional. Like the tenant did not deliberately go and try to structurally damage your property. It's like a lot of times it's accidental, but structural issues can happen inadvertently from tenants. And one that I see, at least around here, because we have expansive soils, is they will not leave their downspouts on. Like the water coming off the roof goes into a gutter and then it drains into a downspout. And so a lot of water can then, you know, go into one area of the house, usually on the corner of a particular house. And so the tenants, they're trying to walk back and forth with their lawnmower or mow underneath it, and they will not leave their downspout down on a property. And so all the water coming off the roof, especially when you have gutters that have very large areas of the roof that they're draining from. So there's a lot of water coming down, and sometimes in a really short amount of time, and it's all coming down within like 2 inches of the foundation on the property. And at least in my marketplace, there's what we have, expansive soils. So the soil gets saturated and expands, and then it contracts when it melts. And so you have movement, you have pressure on the sides of the foundation. And sometimes you'll see damage on a foundation, like the walls bowing or the walls crumbling because someone did not keep their downspouts down. It's not like you leave them down one time and this happens, right? Most of the time it's like repeatedly over months, years in some cases, where you have this thing, pressure keep pushing back and forth, and eventually you have this damage caused by tenants doing something inadvertently, like not keeping their downspouts down. And then you have massive damage. I mean, dealing with a structural issue like that sometimes can be tens of thousands of dollars to address correctly and fix, just because someone did not properly maintain it. So part of that is educating the tenants and expressing to them that you really want them to keep the downspouts down, and maybe even doing things like burying the downspouts and having the water go 6 feet away from the house, so it's not right up against the house dumping all that water on it, especially for large sections of roof that are draining from that. All right, that's sort of my downspout vent. But that is an example, though, of tenants sometimes inadvertently causing damage versus cosmetic damage on property. All right, so what can we do to prevent this type of damage? Well, number one, which we've talked about already, improve tenant screening. Both the process, your written criteria for that, and also the mentality that you're loaning someone a $200,000, a $300,000, a $400,000, a $500,000 asset, and thinking about that as you approve people and as you set your approval criteria. Say, look, am I okay loaning this person a $500,000 asset of mine? You know, I wouldn't loan my best friend a $2,500 laptop, but I'm going to loan this person a $500,000 property. Maybe you should think about that. And, you know, what are you okay with and what that means? Okay. Another thing for prevention, inspect your property thoroughly and regularly. I think if they know that you are going to be popping in and looking at the property once a quarter, or your property manager is going to be popping in just to check in, make sure that everything's going well, make sure there's nothing that needs to be maintained for them and looking at the property, they're much more likely to maintain the property than if they know that you're never coming by and you're never going to look at it. I think it's just human nature. There's certain people that they're going to take care of the property no matter what. But there's a group of people that they only are doing things because they know that someone's going to check up on them. So, you know, if you inspect your property thoroughly and regularly, I think you can cut down on a certain percentage. You could reduce the risk of having your tenant trash your property. Not eliminate it, but I think you could reduce it. Another thing to prevent damage from tenants is having a clear, detailed lease agreement in place that outlines what their responsibilities are, what the expectations are of you. And then stop slippery slopes early by enforcing the lease. If you go over there and they are not doing something that they're supposed to do, you know, you should actually reach out to them, say, hey, look, you know, I just happened to be driving by the neighborhood. I noticed that you haven't mowed your lawn in like 10 days. And I really do need you to do that. It's, you know, it's one of the things in our lease that we need you to do that. If they know that you are checking up on them, they are more likely to comply with other things and to take care of the property a little bit better. And there's this weird positive feedback cycle where a tenant already taking care of the property tends to take care of it in other ways too. So if they're taking care of the outside, they're more likely to be taking care of the inside. Not necessarily like 100%, but I think that there is a positive correlation there. Also, enforce reasonable occupancy limits and occupants to those that are on the lease. So if you know that your town, county, whatever it is, says you cannot have more than five people on a property and they have six, you should enforce that. And make sure that they are not leasing the property with more than what is allowed. And if the occupants on the lease, if there's people moving in that were not on the lease, like someone's boyfriend or girlfriend moves in, or they get remarried, or they get divorced, now they need a roommate, you need to approve those people. You know, I told you the story about the person who got out of prison. They came to the house and they were not approved on my lease. They were not like on the lease itself. It just happened to be the child of the mother. Decided to come home and live with them, you know, 9 months into the lease or so. So you really need to realize that if someone new is moving into your property, you need to actually do like a full tenant screening check on them if they're over 18 years old and make sure that they are approved to live in your property to prevent some of this damage. Because sometimes, this just happened to me actually, you'll have someone move into a property and they'll be fine. They're the initial people, the initial tenant in the property. Then they'll have someone else come in and move in with them. And then the initial person will move out and the person that was the second person to come in stays in the property. And then they bring in a third person. So there's some weird things that can happen on leases like that. You need to make sure you screen and approve of each of those occupants when they add a second one. And especially when the first person leaves and they're no longer responsible for any damage done to the property, because you may not want the person who, especially the third person coming in, who you didn't necessarily approve. So you want to make sure that you enforce reasonable occupancy limits. And also make sure that the occupants that are on the lease are screened and that they are the only ones living in the property. Another way to prevent damage to tenants is maximize security deposits. I think if they know that they have money at risk, they're much more likely to not do damage to the property. And if they do damage, you can actually cover some of the damage with their security deposit. Another thing about prevention, frequent, ideally positive communication with the tenants. Be in touch, stay in touch, realize that you care about the property, you care about them, you care about their situation, and that you want to know what's going on and you want to make sure that they're maintaining the property and that you're checking up on things. And then addressing maintenance issues promptly. If they're like, hey, the landlord doesn't care about the property at all, I don't care about the property then either. If they're okay just letting this sink sit here and I can't use it, then why do I need to maintain anything? And so you got to be really, really careful and make sure that you are doing the maintenance on the property that needs to be done, and you're staying on top of that, and you're communicating with the tenant about the maintenance stuff that's going on the property, and they are much more likely to take care of the property for you doing that. And if you're unwilling or unable to do all this stuff, hire a property manager. So if you're unable or unwilling to go and do all the things you talked about, improve tenant screening, inspecting the property thoroughly and regularly, having a clear, detailed lease and enforcing the lease and enforcing occupancy limits and making sure that the occupants that are in there are totally approved and maximizing security deposits and having communication with the tenants and addressing the maintenance issues promptly. If you're not willing to do all that stuff, just hire someone who is. Hire someone who's a professional and who will do that for you. All right, so what happens if you have damage to the property? Number one, document everything. Tap the security deposit if you need to have things done that was damaged to the property, and collect any deficits. Ask them to pay if they're short on the money that it costs to repair things that was not normal wear and tear. I'm talking about actual damage to properties, and make sure that they pay from that. If they don't, send them to collections. Go collect after the fact. Okay. If they have damage to the property and they're not willing to do anything about it, evict them and then complete the repairs and start over. So if they're violating the lease by damaging the property, evict them, do the repairs, get someone in there in the property who's going to take care of it this time. If it's accidental, like they accidentally drive into the wall of the garage or something like that, and it's covered by insurance, consider making an insurance claim. You know, if you decided to pay the extra fee for getting loss of income insurance, where if your property is vacant for a period of time or whatever, and you have loss of income and the insurance pays a certain amount of that, you can consider making a optional loss of insurance claim on that insurance policy as well. Now, if they stole things from the house, I've heard stories that not had it personally happen, but, you know, a tenant will go in there and they'll cut out the copper piping and sell the copper piping. Or if there's vandalism, they've deliberately gone and damaged things, then you can make a police report claim, pursue legal action against them for actual vandalism claims, and you could probably make an insurance claim, theft and vandalism. Now, your particular insurance policy may or may not cover that. They may or may not cover theft or vandalism done by your tenant. But if it doesn't specifically exclude it, and if it specifically does include it, then you may be able to make a claim to get things that were stolen from your house and or vandalism, deliberate damage done to your property, actually covered by some of your insurance policy. And you got to decide, you know, am I going to make an insurance claim for $500? Probably not. $20,000 where my deductible is $1,000? Probably, right? If you don't have the money to deal with, like, if you have, like, massive damages, you don't have the money, consider bringing in a partner. You know, bring in the partner and say, look, you know, this property, I had to put $100,000 to invest. It's now worth this. There's this amount of equity in it. The cash flow is this amount. I don't have the $50,000 that it needs in repairs. Would you be willing to come in and be a partner on this deal? You do the money for repairs, and, you know, we'll split the ownership of the property based on how much that is in your contribution equity compared to where it was. You could decide to bring in a partner to assist you in doing something like that. What if you have a property and you have all this damage to it and you don't want to do the repairs yourself? Well, one possible thing you can do is you could then convert it to a fixer-upper rent to own, where you allow someone to come in and in exchange for sweat equity, you know, counting toward, you know, their down payments toward purchasing the property or a discount on purchasing the property, they can come in, do the work on the property as a fixer-upper, where you agree to rent the property to them with the ability for them to own it a year or two or three later when they go get a regular loan, or you convert it to owner financing, whatever you decide to do, like however you structure that. But that is a possible option for you to address significant repairs on the property that you're unwilling or unwilling or unable to actually go and do. Or consider selling the property. You're like, hey, listen, I just need to get out of this one, consider selling it. And if things got really, really ugly, give the property back. Do a deed in lieu of foreclosure, or just let it go to foreclosure and deal with the consequences of that. That's sort of like, you know, the most extreme version of this. But, you know, the other thing to do is consider hiring a property manager. Let the property manager bring in their contractors. They've done this before. If they're experienced property managers, they've dealt with a bad turn. They've dealt with tenant damage to a property. Let them come in. Let them do the repairs. Get the property back up. And then you can have them manage it and reduce the risk of this happening again in the future. So in conclusion, you know, life has risk. When we choose to invest in real estate, it has some additional risk, like a tenant possibly trashing a property. Some of these are relatively low frequency. Some of these are kind of like low in severity. If we think about our risk matrix, you know, they're likely to be those. But there are times when you can have one that is a probably still low frequency, but it could be a higher severity thing where you have a tenant just go bad on you. And, you know, we could do some things to prevent that, you know, really good screening, choosing the right business model, you know, choosing less risky business models, choosing, you know, less risky properties and property types and things of that nature. Like, we could do some things to mitigate that risk, but I don't think you can completely eliminate it. So just realize that there is some risk to this, but it's a relatively low risk and it's a low probability risk of it being severe. And you can choose how to handle a lot of those risks. There's definitely things we could do to reduce the probability, to reduce the severity, and make it less likely for it to happen. And we have solutions if it does happen. You know, one of the best solutions, which I probably didn't put on here, but I probably should in the future, is the more reserves you have, the less concern you probably have over these types of issues. You know, if you're sitting on 12 months of reserves on a particular property, on every single property you have, and you have a bad turn, it's much less stressful. Still stressful, but it's much less stressful than if you, you know, or don't have any reserves on your properties and you were kind of like living really close to the bone, trying to, like, you know, push the edge and maximize your return on investment. That's much more stressful. And I think that you'll be less stressed if you have really good reserves and you're ready to handle issues like this, which do come up from time to time, even to the best of us. All right. That's all I got for you. Hope you enjoyed this class. This has been James Orr. Have a great day, everyone. Bye-bye for now.
With home prices up, mortgage interest rates up, and rents up, but not quite enough to counteract the higher prices and interest rates, cash flow on rental properties in Knoxville is harder than ever. Book a call with the Real Estate Financial Planner to apply our proprietary 88 strategies to improve cash flow on your rentals. See the show notes for a link to schedule your call and improve your cash flow today.
If you're a real estate agent, lender, or professional in Knoxville that wants to help our real estate investor listeners, consider reaching out to learn about collaboration opportunities with this podcast. We'd love to add more value to our listeners by having you assist our investors buy, sell, and finance their real estate investments. See the show notes to schedule a call to discuss collaboration opportunities.